Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome indeed on behalf of the Dean and Chapter to Westminster Abbey and to this particular part of it, Poets' Corner, or at least, I suppose, the kind of overspilled car park of Poets' Corner, which, strictly speaking, began round the other side. This is the fourth and final lecture in a splendid series on Anglican women novelists, Excellent Women. The lectures have all been drawn from a forthcoming publication, of which a little more later, and tonight's is dedicated to P.D. James. And incidentally, therefore, it's a very special pleasure to be able to welcome here tonight P.D. James' eldest daughter, Claire, and one of her granddaughters, Beatrice. Warm welcome. It's lovely to have you here. Thank you for being here. And, of course, in particular, to welcome our lecturer, one of the book's co-editors, Professor Alison Schell. Alison is professor in the Department of English at UCL here in London. Prior to this, she was at the University of Durham. Before that, a British Academy postdoctoral research fellow at the University College London. And I think before that, a curator of rare books. Is that right?
Yeah.
And herself has published widely on Shakespeare and religion. You'll be standing, Alison, pretty much in the right place for that. An award-winning study of oral culture and Catholicism in early modern England, and also Catholicism controversy and the English literary imagination. So you have some sense of the wide range of interests. And as I say, Alison is currently involved in this project on Anglican women novelists from Charlotte Bronte to P.D. James, co-editing it with our first lecturer, who's also here tonight. Very good to have you with us, Judith. So, we couldn't be in better hands to introduce this best-selling novelist, P.D. James, tonight, who had such profound interest and engagement with the Church of England, with its language, its traditional forms of worship, and also who was so acutely aware of the depths of human wickedness, which always makes her writing more interesting even, as we get into that. Just a couple of housekeeping notices. In the unlikely event of an emergency, the Abbey staff will direct you. They will quickly be on the scene and direct you to the exits. That's probably the only thing I need to say about that. And of course, please, if you would switch to silent your mobile phones or any other mobile devices and desires you have, please keep them quiet. It's now our great pleasure to welcome Alison Schell, Professor Alison Schell.
Thank you so much, Vernon, and thank you all for coming. Thanks to the Dean Chapter of Westminster Abbey for providing truly excellent support and these inspiring surroundings. Everybody should have a handout looking like this. On it are all the longer quotations that I'll be referring to, and I'll be talking you through the handout as I go. And can everybody hear me? Great. If you can't at any point, then wave. One of the most bracing media events of the last decade took place in the last days of 2009 on the Today programme, when the 89-year-old P.D. James, a guest presenter of the programme and a former governor of the BBC, interrogated Mark Thompson, then the Director General of the BBC, over salary structures and public service standards. Her courtesy was unwavering, her recall remarkable, her interrogation remorseless. Thompson never stood a chance. If you've never heard the interview, it's on YouTube. It's an inspiration to senior citizens everywhere. And it's often the case, I think, that veteran novelists become spokesmen on moral or religious matters. That's certainly true of James, when she wasn't exhorting BBC executives about their duty, she was championing the King James Bible and the Book of Common Prayer. And acting as Vice President of the Prayer Book Society and serving on the Liturgical Commission of the Church of England at the time when Common Worship was being put together. And all this was reinforced by her willingness, unusual in a high-profile lay person of her era, to speak about her Christian faith in public. As an Anglican, she was able to make non-Anglicans take her seriously. As a Tory peer, she acted out her belief in public service. She presented an attractive and responsible version of conservatism, even to those who disagreed with her politics. She was that rare thing, an establishment figure who actually was great and good. Nobody appears to have had a bad word to say about her. And no wonder. What comes over from the interviews and tributes I've read is just how likeable she seems to have been. I wish I'd met her. Though I did encounter her over email in the last year of her life, when Judith Maltby and I hoped we might persuade her to write an afterword to our series of essays on Anglican women novelists. She refused, pleading pressure of work. My guess is that she must have been clearing her desk. But she wrote at length. She didn't have to, but she did. And she wrote with tremendous kindness. And she expressed an informed enthusiasm for the project. And it means a lot to us both that she gave our book an imprimatur. It felt appropriate that the last of our essays should be a study of her. Not least because, as you'll hear in a minute, her career and her writings so often and so consciously recall her predecessors. Well, everything I've said so far begs the question, how could this woman of such rectitude and gentility and warmth have dreamt up such bleak and violent detective novels? It can be a struggle to reconcile James's public persona with her fiction. She can give one the feeling that Little Red Riding Hood's grandmother has been taking masterclasses from the wolf. Hers must have been a complex personality. And in my talk today, I should be making a very preliminary attempt to get to grips with that complexity and a theological imagination that could sometimes be quite unruly. But let me begin by saying something about James's predecessors and the various traditions within which she was writing. Within this series of lectures, you've already heard from speakers on Rose Macaulay, Dorothy L. Sayers, and Barbara Pym, all figures from an earlier generation of Anglican women novelists, all people who can, I think, be productively compared with James. As both writer and pundit, James could be called the Sayers of her generation. Both queens of crime, both theologically engaged, both unapologetically learned. One specific point of correspondence that interests me is James's fondness for setting her novels in the bleak, threatening East Anglian landscape. Devices and Desires would be one such. Very strongly recalling Sayers' classic evocation of the Fenlands in The Nine Tailors. That's the one on bell ringing. And James shares Rose Macaulay's interest in those on the fringes of the church. Her best-known detective, Adam Dalgliesh, hovers on the threshold of commitment in a way that I find strongly reminiscent of Laurie in Macaulay's novel The Towers of Trebizond, about which Judith was speaking in the first lecture in this series. And finally, James was a great Pym fan. She spoke to the Barbara Pym Society in 2003. She alludes to her in her fiction more than once. And I've given you, on your handouts, one example. The context is that Father Barnes, who's the rather ineffectual parish priest in her 1989 novel A Taste for Death, is harking wistfully back to the time when the clergy were lionised simply because of their office. His most recent library book had been a Barbara Pym. He had read with envious disbelief the gentle and ironic story of a village parish where the curates were entertained, fed and generally spoilt by the female members of the congregation. The reference as James's ideal reader would instantly recognise, and I'm sure many of you did, is to Barbara Pym's early novel, Some Tame Gazelle, where Harriet Bede cossets a series of curates and her sister Belinda yearns platonically for the local archdeacon. We heard Jane Williams talking about Some Tame Gazelle last week. Well, James often used her precursor's treatment of Anglicanism to point out differences between past and present. This reference to Some Tame Gazelle makes light-hearted use of a theme which preoccupied her throughout her career, the changes in Anglicanism during her lifetime. In particular, the decline in its social centrality and status. I'll be talking more about that later. But it's also a statement of continuity. It's embodying the persistent relationship between the Anglican Church and women novelists. And naturally, James is well aware of her predecessors in the field of the whodunit. In her study of the field, talking about detective fiction, she pays tribute not only to Dorothy L. Sayers, but to another devout Anglican, somebody else who could easily have gone in, due to this in my volume, Agatha Christie. I wonder if James's engagement with the changing fortunes of Anglicanism owes something to Christie's sense in her later works that she was chronicling a transitional period, well illustrated by a comment of Miss Marple's, who else, in a late whodunit, Nemesis, published in 1971, quotation 2 on your handouts. In my own village, St Mary Mead, Miss Marple says, things do rather revolve round the church. I mean, they always have. In my young days, that was so. Nowadays, of course, it's rather different. Well, Nemesis marks Miss Marple's last appearance in a full-length novel. Murder at the Vicarage, 1930, that was published in, where she's introduced to the public, epitomises the importance of the Anglican Church within Golden Age detective fiction, therefore within the imaginative tradition to which James is reacting in her own era. Christie's title is very suggestive. Murder at the Vicarage, the centre of a parish community. It's a social solecism as much as anything. In Christie's hands, whodunits do contain strong elements of comedy. At moments, they remind me of Philip King's 1944 farce, See How They Run, set in a vicarage living room. It contains the memorable line, "Arrest most of these vicars." Farces and murder mysteries can indeed be quite similar. They both show the temporary disruption of respectability, normal social rhythms. They both reimpose order at the end. Christie saw herself primarily as an entertainer. She'd probably have acknowledged that comic resolution was part of her agenda. But, like other Golden Age detective writers, she's now valued at least as much for another, more accidental solace. Her work's taken on a nostalgic glow in retrospect. And the fact that writers of that era tended to downplay graphic violence has given a blueprint to present-day writers of so-called cosy detective novels, or simply just cosies. These vary quite a bit in quality, I think, but the best are really good. They're marketed as suitable for those who dislike the graphic crime fiction which has taken the legacy of Golden Age detective novelists in another direction entirely. Sometimes in the world of the cosy whodunit, bloody murder can seem as toothsomely English as strawberry jam on a scone. And that can pose as much of an ethical problem to the thoughtful reader as voyeuristic depictions of extreme violence. The Anglican Church figures prominently in the cosy detective novel, and that's sometimes just to evoke, as Christie did, a world of parochial order ruptured by murder, reinstated by the detective. But the genre also provides opportunities for writers wishing to undertake more ambitious depictions of church life, including such up-to-date developments as ordained women detectives. Kate Charles's Callie Anson, a woman priest battling prejudice, offers quite an interesting slant on the common idea of sleuth as outsider. And I've also enjoyed the work of many other writers who've been identified as belonging to the tradition of cosies, such as D.M. Greenwood's series featuring Deaconess Theodora Braithwaite. Audience members may have other recommendations. I'd be delighted to hear them. But James is different again. For all her own homage to Christie and to other Golden Age predecessors, her novels are far more violent, desolate, noirish than was typical of writers of that era. Does that make her an Iron Age detective novelist? Does it perhaps make her a writer of Anglican Gothic fiction? Within literary criticism, the term Gothic novel signals two things. Firstly, a literary fashion of the late 18th and early 19th centuries, the horrid mysteries of the kind that Jane Austen famously satirises in Northanger Abbey. It also indicates a more general imaginative fascination with the ruined, the haunted, the moribund. And at its outset, Gothic fiction drew inspiration from the history of Catholicism in England, both its medieval past and, at the turn of the 19th century, its troublingly half-concealed present. And I think there's an interesting analogy here to the later 20th century, when Anglicanism in turn has been cast into part shadow. Not, of course, a simple story of decline. Before this audience, I surely don't need to make an extended case for the Church of England's continued worldwide strength and, at best, robustly successful approach to change. But I don't need to labour the point either that it's been faced with several challenges in the country of its inception. Ebbing congregations in many areas, religious pluralism, some practising Christians' scepticism about the value of denominational allegiance, the ever-increasing respectability of unbelief, the practical outworkings of secularism, media commentary that's often uninformed or hostile, or both. One could go on. And there's a wider issue here too. Outside clearly delineated contexts, such as Radio 4's Thought for the Day, England's public sphere has not been hospitable for quite a while to expressions of any religious belief, Anglican or not. And James herself nods to this silencing in A Taste for Death, in which a murdered Tory politician, Sir Paul Brown, experiences an abrupt religious conversion before the novel begins. A member of Brown's constituency describes to Dalgleish the embarrassment of a conversation with the dead man. That's over the page on your handouts, number 3. He said that it wouldn't be right for him to continue as our member. It was time that his life took a different turn. Naturally, I asked what he meant by a different turn. He said that he didn't know yet. He hadn't been shown. Hadn't been shown by whom, I asked. He said, God. Well, there's not much a man can say to that. Nothing like an answer like that for putting a stopper on rational discussion. While this constraint affects all religions, it's had an especially pronounced effect on the Church of England because of its previous cultural dominance, and that, I think, is where the notion of Gothic comes into play. In a well-known essay, Freud described the uncanny as that class of the terrifying that leads back to something long known to us, once very familiar. If that's true, the current position of Anglicanism has considerable power to generate uncanniness. And James's densely imagined church buildings are a focus for this kind of disquiet, and often enough, a location for murder. Sometimes she uses a Gothic, medievalising mise-en-scene. In Death in Holy Orders, 2001, an unpopular archdeacon set on modernising a theological college is found battered to death beneath a medieval painting of the Last Judgment, as if he too is hellbound. And James is sometimes even perceived as more Gothic than she is. I've already quoted from A Taste for Death, which begins with a double murder in a London Anglo-Catholic church near Paddington. She carefully describes it as Italianate. She's wonderful on architecture, I think. I've reproduced the cover design for one of its reissues. It's on your handouts. And you can see that the illustrator has imagined it as featuring slightly mad Gothic tracery. There's a particularly striking combination of classical repose and Gothic horror in an early novel of James's, Death of an Expert Witness. That's famous as the one where she drew most on her background in forensic science. Here, there's a stately home repurposed as a laboratory, as the setting for much of the action, and it has a chapel by Sir Christopher Wren, obviously a classical architect. And it's largely unused under the new regime. When asked about its security, the laboratory director comments, "There's nothing left here of real value." Functions more broadly, I think, this comment as a secularist dismissal. At a later point in the novel, Brenda Pridmore, who's a young employee at the laboratory, believes she's being followed by the murderer, and she rushes there for safety. Next quotation on your handout. "And now there was a belt of trees before her, and gleaming through the autumn branches, the Wren Chapel, lit from within, beckoning and holy, shining like a picture on a Christmas card. She ran towards it, palms outstretched, as hundreds of her forebears in the dark fens must have rushed to their altars for sanctuary. She threw herself against the oak, and the great door swung inwards into a glory of light. At first, her mind, shocked into stupor, refused to recognise what her dazzled eyes so clearly saw. Stella Mawson's face, dreadful in death, drooped above her, the eyes half open, the palms disposed outwards as if in a mute appeal for pity or for help. Startling scene that, focusing on the corpse's gesture of unanswered prayer, subverting any sense that churches yield any obvious sanctuary. A similar point is made about the building itself. We learn that it has hosted an adulterous liaison, and that it was a safe place for this because the locals avoided it. The fen villagers, one of the short quotations that I haven't included on the handouts, the fen villagers would have had a half-superstitious dread of visiting this empty and alien shrine. In this and other ways, it appears spiritually void. Brenda comments, reflecting on her experience there, "It's a funny chapel, isn't it? Not really a holy place. Perhaps it hasn't been prayed in enough." Dalgleish ponders, and this is quotation 5 on your handouts, "Its formal classicism rejected emotion. It enshrined man, not God. Reason, not mystery. This was a place where certain reassuring rituals had been enacted, reaffirming its proprietor's view of the proper order of the universe and its own place in that order." This passage surely dispels any idea that James was indiscriminately nostalgic for the Anglican past. Exploring the chapel, Dalgleish finds a copy of the Book of Common Prayer. Tellingly, it looked unused. And it falls open at the passage from Psalm 39, which forms part of the burial service. "For I am a stranger with thee and a sojourner, as all my fathers were. Oh, spare me a little, that I may recover my strength before I go hence and be no more seen." These words and the book from which they're taken constitute the chapel's only source of spiritual efficacy. In the following chapter, we're shown Dalgleish sitting quietly in one of the stalls, apparently engrossed by the Book of Common Prayer. Discreetly, James leaves us to ponder whether he's praying or whether he's just reading. And when Dalgleish first handles this prayer book, he finds some human hairs under it. It's a clue, but it's an inconclusive one, as if to frustrate simplistic expectations of providential intervention. Providential implications, though, do undergird a taste for death. Again, this is in the context of the prayer book. Dalgleish has been listening to Evensong. This is a kind of intervention, I think, of James's that most neglected and aesthetically satisfying portion of the Anglican liturgy in an Anglo-Catholic church where he's investigating a double murder. Next quotation on your handouts. Father Barnes's voice, as if from a far distance but very clear, perhaps because the words were so familiar, was speaking the third collect for aid against all perils. Lighten our darkness, we beseech thee, O Lord, and by thy great mercy defend us from all perils and dangers of this night, for the love of thine only Son, our Saviour, Jesus Christ. James revealed in one interview that she used this collect every night in her own devotions. Within this novel, its plea for enlightenment and defence seems very appropriate for policemen and detectives. And it heralds the moment, just after the service, when a crucial clue, a silver button from the murderer's jacket, is found in a money box for votive candles by the statue of the Virgin and Child. And that recalls an earlier episode, when, just after Dalgleish's first inspection of the bodies, he lights a candle in front of the same statue, and he leaves payment for it. And he's quite conscious of how strange the action might appear to his junior colleagues. Quotation 7 on your handouts. On impulse, he felt in his pocket for a tenpenny piece and dropped it into the box. The clatter was unnaturally loud. He half expected to hear Kate or Massingham moving up behind him to watch, unspeaking but with interested eyes, his untypical act of sentimental folly. He stuck the candle upright in a socket, then sat and gazed at the flame, letting it mesmerise him into memory. At the very least, he's meditating. I think James is suggesting he's also praying, not least because the chapter section stops here. We're invited to fill the gap. And certainly the clue emerges later as if in response to an unspoken, barely articulated prayer. James was well used to burying clues. James's readers were primed to look for them. Once noticed, the convergence between these two episodes is hard to ignore. Well, we don't take kindly these days, whatever our religious beliefs or lack of them, to God directly intervening in fiction to resolve the plot. Yet James has anticipated this problem too. The button probably gets in the box because Darren, who's a 10-year-old boy who's one of the first to discover the bodies, substitutes it for a coin. As he walks up to the church with his friend Miss Wharton, she hands him the usual tenpenny piece for a candle. Now, James tells us, she heard a faint tinkle and watched it while he stuck his candle in the socket. Of course, the noise could be made both by a coin and by a metal button. We learn later in the story that Darren's badly brought up and a habitual pilferer. He's even less likely than most children of his age to see no contradiction between lighting a votive candle and stealing from the church. And readers looking for a material explanation can stop there. Those searching for a providentialist outcome, or perhaps agreeably surprised to be offered the option of one, have got it too, though in a way which is anything but glib. On the one hand, we're invited to speculate on the contingent subterranean workings of a providence that can redeem Darren's petty crime in a way that brings a far worse criminal to justice. On the other, it's hinted that an answer to prayer may bring additional horrors in its wake. And this is a bit of a spoiler alert, when the button's discovered, it leads directly to the murderer, but this key piece of evidence emerges too late to avoid an extra death. The Catholic priest and detective novelist Ronald Knox decreed that all supernatural agencies should be ruled out in detective stories. This borderline providential incident stretches his famous dictum, and it also challenges the idea that God necessarily brings about happy endings. This episode illustrates that James writes about prayer the way that Victorians wrote about sex. That's to say, with the utmost delicacy and indirection. and that's entirely in keeping with Dalgliesh's character. He's a vicar's son. He's shown as comfortable within Anglican surroundings and well accustomed to them. He's also shown as intellectually fastidious, emotionally inhibited, equivocal towards religious faith. And James may have had pragmatic reasons for this. Depicting Dalgliesh as a paid-up Christian would have compromised his cleverness for some of her readers, undoubtedly. But this sceptical distancing from belief makes Dalgliesh, if anything, a particularly authoritative witness to the evil he encounters. And for a genre that foregrounds the process of rational deduction, detective fiction often has a lot to say about supra-rational perceptions of good and evil. Back to Miss Marple. When it's suggested to her that she has a very fine sense of evil, she responds, that's quotation 8 on your handouts. Yes, perhaps. I have at several different times in my life been apprehensive, have recognised that there was evil in the neighbourhood, the surroundings, that the environment of someone who was evil was near me, connected with what was happening. It's rather, you know, like being born with a very keen sense of smell. And James echoes this idea in her portrayal of Michael Baddeley, the priest whose murder precipitates the plot in The Dark Tower, an early novel of James's. And Baddeley is chaplain to a nursing home run by a bizarre Anglican religious community. And he dies because he correctly suspects that the organisation is being used as a front for criminal activities. He doesn't suspect this because of any tangible clues, but because of, I quote, a deep-rooted instinct for what he would describe as evil. And on the face of it, suspicion of this kind is a strikingly inadequate cause for murdering someone, which does testify to the murderer's unbalanced state of mind. But it also conveys a vivid impression of Father Baddeley's spiritual perceptiveness, made all the more suggestive by the fact that the reader never encounters him directly. He's dead before the novel begins. Actually, not quite dead before the novel begins, but we never meet him. Suspicions about Father Baddeley's death first arise because his corpse is found wearing a purple stole, as if he'd been interrupted in administering the sacrament of confession. Now, confession is often very useful to the detective novelist. James surely knew the next instance I'm going to the next quotation on your handouts, which occurs in Dorothy L. Sayers' Unnatural Death of 1927. Lord Peter Wimsey has an assistant, Catherine Climpson, a woman of enormous high church piety. And that is crucial to the finding and interpretation of one particular clue, which she happens upon as the result of a minor accident after Vespers. Next quotation. Miss Climpson gathered up a quantity of little manuals and groped for her gloves. In doing so, she dropped her office book. It fell, annoyingly, behind the long kneeler, scattering as it went a small Pentecostal shower of Easter cards, bookmarkers, sacred pictures, dried palms and Ave Marias into the dark corner behind the confessional. Well, back home, Miss Climpson goes through her devotional books, reinserting the prayer cards, and she finds something she's picked up by accident. A sheet of notes made in preparation for confession, which contains a vital pointer as to the identity of the murderer. And this puts her in a dilemma. Should she disclose it or shouldn't she? After all, it wasn't intended for her eyes. It could be seen as affected by the seal of the confessional. And she asks to put a case of conscience to the vicar, and she writes a letter to Lord Peter and his collaborator, Inspector Parker, quote, so obscure and mysterious and lavishly underlined and interlined that it was perhaps fortunate for their reason that they were never faced with it. Perhaps it is providential that the identity of the murderer then becomes clear for other reasons. In James's The Black Tower, the practice of confession is differently revelatory, not least because Father Baddeley is killed when his priestly obligation to provide it brings about his death. In the end, it's Dalgliesh who hears the confession instead, reminding the reader that detectives and priests have overlapping concerns. The murderer triumphantly recounts his confrontation with Father Baddeley to Dalgliesh. Number 10, quotation on your handouts. When he accused me of using Toynton for some purpose of my own, I said that I would tell him the truth, that I wanted to make my confession. He must have known in his heart this was death, that I was only amusing myself. But he couldn't take the risk. If he refused to take me seriously, his whole life would have been a lie. Father Baddeley's murdered because of his terrifying spiritual insight. We're invited to believe that he goes to his death living out his faith and vocation. It's a discreet martyrdom, unusual within a genre so concerned with bad and violent death. Back to the idea of James as Gothic novelist. The Black Tower, as its title indicates, is very much playing with ideas of the Gothic. And the fate of Grace Williston, who's an inmate of the nursing home, illustrates this particularly well. Grace Willison is a high Anglican spinster from the same stock as, say, is Miss Climpson. And she's killed because she's responsible for sending out the community's newsletter. Surely the quintessential task of an excellent woman. She has perfect recall of the names and addresses on the mailing list, and the fact that some of these contacts are criminal means she'll be able to compromise the murderer. Accordingly, she's killed by what seems like a personification of death. Quotes, a cloaked figure, hood well down, obscuring the face, moving swiftly towards her, on silent feet like an apparition. Which can be explained on a literal level by the fact that members of the community wear monks' habits. But the passage unashamedly channels the Gothic element in the novel, and with it a twinge of superstitious fear. It leads us not to be particularly surprised at the murder when it happens. And this moment set up when, just before Grace's death, we hear her nighttime musings. Next quotation on your handouts. Lighten our darkness. Her mother had always liked that collect. And by thy great mercy, defend us from all the perils and dangers of this night. Only there was no peril here. Only sleeplessness and pain. Of course, it's drawing on the Book of Common Prayer again, you've already heard the quotation I gave you earlier from A Taste of Death, where the collect against all perils is referenced. And there, the petition, Lighten Our Darkness, heralds enlightenment when the clue is discovered. In the Black Tower, it's a much more difficult reference, an ironic one, given that Grace is about to be murdered. Well, James's advocacy of traditional Anglican worship is very evident here, as it has been, I think, in a lot of the other quotations I've given. During James's lifetime, as part of a move towards liturgical modernisation, the Authorised Version and the Book of Common Prayer and their various revisions had ceased to be standard provision in Church of England services. And then and now, when it happened and now, it was deplored by many, both inside and outside Anglicanism. The well-known author and professional derider of Christianity, Philip Pullman, is just one member of the latter camp. And non-believers like him, who voiced their disapproval, saw the sidelining of Anglicanism's literary heritage as an act of cultural philistinism. James would have agreed with him about that, if little else. Within her fiction, she seldom misses an opportunity to advocate what she saw as liturgical soundness. For instance, in The Skull Beneath the Skin, published in 1982, features a service of morning prayer, commissioned by an obsessive Victorianist, Ambrose Gorringe. Surely it's after James's own heart, We're told it uses the 1662 Book of Common Prayer without deletions or substitutions, and that, quotation 12 on your handouts, the congregation proclaimed themselves miserable offenders who had followed too much the devices and desires of their own hearts and promised amendment of life in a slightly ragged but resolute chorus. And afterwards, the detective Cordelia Gray, whose charge Clarissa Lyle had just been murdered, reflects that, for the first time since Clarissa's murder, her restless, menacing spirit was subdued. For a few precious moments, the weight of guilt and misery lifted from her own heart. It was possible to believe, innocently talking in the sun, that life was as well-ordered, as certain, as austerely decent and reasonable as the great Anglican compromise in which they had taken part. Plainly, this service is not just a historical reenactment. It's a cathartic event. It's simultaneously soothing and disturbing. On the one hand, it provides psychological reassurance for the members of the house party after a shocking murder. On the other, the fact that a killer is one of their number and hasn't yet been identified gives the congregation's self-accusation an urgent pertinence. Miserable offenders indeed. And the liturgical phrases quoted by James are from the Book of Common Prayer's General Confession. At the time the novel was published, it had been supplanted by the version in the Alternative Service Book. And within the latter, the congregation declared that they have sinned against God and their fellow men in thought and word and deed, through negligence, through weakness, through our own deliberate fault. It's a comprehensive admission of imperfection, but it contrasts markedly with the Book of Common Prayer's requirement for a body of worshippers to call themselves miserable offenders who have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts, which presents self-hatred and distrust of human capabilities as exemplary. Would have been much more acceptable as a collective affirmation to the Tudors and Stuarts than in the 20th century. But it does speak far more strikingly than its modern equivalent to the evils presented in James's novel. That's why I used the phrase miserable offenders as my title this evening. And it's one illustration of how James's dislike of liturgical change goes well beyond belletrism, pedantry and nostalgia. She's much more serious than that. She's sensitive to its religious implications. She deprecated the passing of a time when liturgy engaged with the dark. James's thought was permeated by apprehensions of evil. When she was asked in 2012, "Do you believe in good and evil in a Manichaean way? Or do you see human nature as much more murky and ambiguous?" She replied, and this is number 13 on your handouts. "I believe in good and evil in a Manichaean way. Evil is a positive force. To me, this seems close to human experience." Well, of course, an off-the-cuff interview comment shouldn't be taken as a fully worked-out credo. Still, James was scholarly enough to know what was implied by her self-identification. A dualistic view of the world, governed by the perception of conflict between light and darkness. Manichaeanism is sometimes described as a Christian heresy, at other times as a religion in its own right, incorporating elements of Christianity. Either way, it's characterised by the notion that evil has a material existence. Mainstream Christianity follows the formulation of St. Augustine, himself a Manichaean in early life, and defines evil as the privation of good. Of course, the idea of Manichaeanism is often used in a loose sense too, typifying a tendency to see good and evil as binary opposites. Either way, this dualistic way of viewing the world is very well suited to murder mysteries. I would argue that the notion of Manichaeanism is a helpful way of approaching James's fiction. Detective fiction was too highly evolved by the late 20th century James's too sophisticated writer within this genre for her novels to deploy caricatured murderers and flawless sleuths. But evil drives the story in a detective novel. You could say this gives the genre an intrinsic leaning towards the Manichaean heresy. And James even features two self-confessed adherents to Manichaeanism in a late work, The Lighthouse, 2005, that was published in. In the next quotation on your handouts, one of these adherents, an alcoholic priest, Adrian Boyd, is described by his carer, Jo Staveley. She's talking to Dalgliesh. He came to believe that God couldn't be both good and all-powerful. Life's a struggle between the two forces, good and evil, God and the devil. That's some kind of heresy. A long word, beginning with M. Dalgliesh said, Manichaeanism. That sounds like it. It seems sensible to me. At least it explains the suffering of the innocent, which otherwise takes some sophistry to make sense of. If I had a religion, that's what I'd choose. I suppose I became a Manichaean, if that's the word, without knowing it. The first time I watched a child dying of cancer. But apparently you're not supposed to believe it if you're a Christian. And I suppose particularly not if you're a priest. Well, James's fascination with evil goes well beyond the narrative demands of a detective story. This exchange illustrates how much the problem of undeserved suffering features in her work. And so, too, just as ubiquitous, is a near-apocalyptic vein of social disenchantment, especially in her later novels, where evil's identified with the consequences of political arrogance. I think that's particularly true of her novel, The Children of Men, which presents some dystopian speculations about the future, so it's outside the run of detective stories. Did anyone see the brilliant and chilling TV dramatisation of The Handmaid's Tale recently, Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel? Yes, a few hands up. OK. I think what James is doing in The Children of Men is something a bit like The Handmaid's Tale, but giving an Anglican slant to it. That would take a whole nother lecture. But in her detective fiction too, it's interesting how she seems to be involved with her own politics sometimes. Her anger cuts across policies typical of the Conservative Party that she belonged to sometimes. For instance, in 2003 novel The Murder Room, the knock-on effect of welfare cuts drives a desperate wife who's caring for her husband with Alzheimer's to kill him and take her own life. Heresies do throw up points of tension within Christianity, and they have a history of reinventing themselves when new difficulties arise. And the fierce topical commentary in a novel like The Murder Room indicates how the Manichaean tendency in James's writing could be stimulated by contemporary problems. And paradoxically, it could also suggest the desirability of taking flight from the ordinary world. Manichaeanism is a form of Gnostic belief. All Gnosticism is characterised by the idea that spiritual enlightenment can only be achieved through knowledge. And during James's lifetime, the modes of thought with Gnostic ancestry had a bit of currency among commentators, notably the famous critic Harold Bloom, who shared her keen respect for England's literary heritage and her distrust of populism. I think James is aware of, kind of, finding that quite attractive. And in her fiction, that's played out against the backdrop of Anglican modernisation, nowhere more insistently than in a late novel, Death in Holy Orders, where the plot revolves around St Anselm's, that's a conservative, intellectually elitist theological college, being threatened with closure by Archdeacon Crampton, an insensitive modernizer. I already referred to Crampton's grand guignol death earlier in this talk. Well, before he dies, he passes the remark that the college has become irrelevant to the new age. And the college principal, Father Sebastian, bristles up. And this is the last quotation on your handouts. What is it that you want? A church without mystery, stripped of that learning, tolerance and dignity that were the virtues of Anglicanism? A church without humility in the face of the ineffable mystery and love of Almighty God? A service with banal hymns, a debased liturgy, and the Eucharist conducted as if it were a parish bean feast? A church for cool Britannia? Remember that phrase? Typical of the book's dialogues on the state of Anglicanism, which read often like the dramatisation of James's personal concerns. It's rather as if Dalgleish and the reader are being asked to detect who killed the Church of England. But the paradox of James' career is that in feeding this appetite for Gothic tales of Anglican decline, she gave new life to the Church of England's literary heritage. Using this mass-market genre, the detective story, she perhaps did a better job than her clerical contemporaries in disseminating knowledge of the authorised version of the Book of Common Prayer. Not just because she was sensitive to their stylistic merits, but because, in her view, they spoke better to a fallen world than more modern translations and liturgies. It's a fascination with fallenness that drives her work. It makes her, like Miss Marple, like her own creation, Father Baddeley, unerringly able to zone in on sin and wickedness. No wonder she experienced evil as a positive force, the way Manichaeans saw it. In her lifetime, James was thought the consummate Anglican novelist. But I think she herself was sharply aware of being imaginatively goaded in a direction incompatible with Orthodox Christianity. As we all know, Anglicanism is a broad church, but for one of England's most prominent lay Anglicans to call herself a Manichaean, even in passing, it takes one aback. But as articulated by James, it reminds us that detective novels are shaped by evil. Dealing, as any detective novelist must, with extreme human wickedness, James finds no adequate secular response to it. Instead, she uses the Anglican literary heritage to recall a time when evil was, to her mind, more explicitly confronted within liturgy, within sacrament. Her advocacy of traditional Anglicanism does tap into the vein of cultural and political conservatism within her writing, but it transcends simple nostalgia through a sense that language and practice, hallowed by generations of believers, can act as a partial bulwark against wickedness, deliver us from evil indeed. Well, I was going to end there, but I was given, just before I began, by James's daughter and granddaughter, a sermon that she preached at St. Edward's, Cambridge in 2005, on the Book of Common Prayer, and it has an irresistible ending, and actually a much more positive and upbeat one than the one I prepared. So I think there's providence at work here, and I'm going to end by reading it out. Praise for the Bible and the prayer book as literature would, of course, have been incomprehensible to Tyndale and to Cranmer. Tyndale was translating into the language of the common people the good news of man's salvation and the hope of everlasting life. Cranmer was setting out to establish a firm version, a firm foundation for the Reformed Church in worship and theology. I wonder if, working patiently through the long hours and glancing at the leaping flames in their fireplaces, they had a fleeting premonition of the terrible death that awaited them. I hope not, but who can tell? Yet, as a writer, I like to think that both had a creative joy in their genius, that they knew the supreme satisfaction of putting the right words in the right order, and that snuffing out their candles at the end of the working day and looking back at what they had achieved, they knew that it was good. I think she knew what she was talking about. Thank you very much.